Accession number 27083, Reel 2.
Sir Henry, you were rebuked by your mother for failing to acknowledge the under-housemaid. I think that's where we left.
Yes.
The tape.
And she was absolutely right, of course. I was brought up, and I'm duly grateful for it. My father being in the Navy, he was away a great deal of the time. And in those days, a foreign commission was 2.5 years. And when he was away, it fell to my mother to exert discipline and so forth. And the domestic arrangements were very shrewdly split. My grandmother dealt with the inside of the house and so gave the cook orders for what they had for which meals and that sort of thing. But my mother dealt with all the outside stuff, which suited them both admirably. And that was fine. Well, now I come on to my vintage, more or less. There were four boys. And the eldest, John, I never knew because he died in infancy before I was of this world. And the second one, Roger, was 4 years older than me, and I'll return to him in a moment. And he went on and was in his pretty well his 80s, I think, when he eventually died. Then there was then there was me, and then there was a younger brother called Guy, and that brings me really to what I remember as a sort of black winter. I've tried to pinpoint the precise year that this occurred, and I think it was across 1929-1930. It was that sort of thing, give or take a year. For a reason that I can't remember, our normal nanny, Mahela, wasn't with us that winter. And we had a temporary one, great big woman who was a stranger, and was, I'm sure, perfectly nice, but we didn't really get to know her. And come November or so, she died in the house. I can't remember what of. That was the first thing. The next thing that happened was that my elder brother, Roger, went down with pneumonia, quite seriously. And in those days, of course, there were no antibiotics, and the only hope for pneumonia was good nursing, which he got, but he was very ill indeed. And in the next door room to mine, my younger brother developed a fairly vicious whooping cough. And I could hear him through the wall, coughing away and that sort of thing. And then I developed whooping cough, but very mildly. I mean, just an occasional splutter and so forth. And younger brother Guy died of whooping cough. And as a result of all this, the entire family decamped, and we went on a long sea voyage out to Cape Town in, I think it was the Carnarvon Castle. And we only had 4 days or so in Cape Town, and then we returned in the Windsor Castle. May have got those the wrong way around, but that'll do. Both Union Castle Line, of course. And on the way back, we spent 3 weeks in Madeira. This was really to get over, and I'm talking now of January, February, March, to get over the harsher bits of the English winter. And while we were in Madeira, sticks in my mind, they had a revolution. And it wasn't a very serious one, but the rebels decided that they wanted to cut loose from Portugal and run their own show. And it was quite an upset for those days. And the Royal Navy sent a cruiser to stand by, just like that, to stand by any Brits that happened to be staying in Madeira at the time, and several were. And I remember being taken on board for lunch, because I think it was the commander rather than the captain, knew my pa, and heard that we were there, and that was that. Well, then the rebels weren't terribly successful. The Portuguese main authorities were completely flabbergasted, didn't know what to do. But the rebels put together bits and pieces of ironwork from the local banana factory, and they contrived to build a sort of muzzle-loading cannon. And the great day came that they were going to do a test firing with this piece, and they dragged it to the edge of a cliff, and they got some gunpowder or whatever from somewhere, and they loaded it, and they touched it off, and the entire Chamotl blew up. And they were very lucky, because nobody was hurt. And that was the end of the revolution. They had good revolutions in those days, didn't they? Well, then, subsequent years, for the next 2 years, we again moved out of Yana, and we rented a little house in Sidmouth. Delightful house. It was really two or three houses in one, all joined together. Absolutely on the cliff edge, but by the sea, and so warmer climes. And we were 600 feet up or so at Yana, because of the moor and so forth. And again, in the spring, we took to going out to Tenerife in the Canary Islands, where we had an honorary uncle who I couldn't stand, but that's another matter, and some other visitor. And we took over the rather small top floor of the main hotel in Orotava, away from Santa Cruz, the main capital of the island. And most of the hotel, the center portion and one wing, had been completely gutted by fire. So we had this rather small top floor, and it didn't have a bathroom. We had to move elsewhere for that, and so on. And we spent, I suppose, 6 or 8 weeks there, largely for my brother's benefit. My brother, I may say, was a great strapping lad. He was 3-4 times my size, and strong as an ox. And in retrospect, I think he was, albeit understandably, I think he was mollycoddled, as a result of which he missed virtually all his school time. And he had a tutor who was a rather curious man. He'd done time in Africa. Mr. Kerr was his name. Didn't have much of a sense of humor, but there it was. And he educated my brother, Roger. I thought it was highly infradig to be taught arithmetic by my mother. And why couldn't I be taught whatever I needed to be taught by the tutor? So I used to nudge up there with varying effects and so forth. We didn't get on terribly well. But just to sort of dust over my brother, and this is not his life story, it's meant to be mine, but he was due, as a result of all this, of course, he didn't go to Dartmouth. And the idea was that he would go to Eton and maybe come in through the public school entry. And then the family doctor, who was a marvellous man and years ahead of his time, who lived in Newton Abbot, not far away, and was the sort of person that even as a small boy you took to and thought, you know, oh, what a really nice person. And there was a great rapport. And he always used to arrive just as the clock was striking 1 o'clock and we'd moved into lunch. And he had a little car and a chauffeur, and he wore a grey bowler. And he was a marvellous man. His name was Dr. Hayden. And he was, even in his latter years, he was a fund of good, commonsensical medical know-how, and so on. And he said, you know, I don't know about this chap going to Eton, because he'll have to do a bit of work there. And he's never been used to any mental work in his life. And so on. So he raised doubts about the wisdom of this. By this time, my father was away at sea again. And so it went on. Well, then, so he didn't go to Eton. And the idea was that he'd go to Cambridge. But again, the doctor was in some doubt, and not sure if he'd reached the entry age. Anyway, he didn't go to Cambridge. And then came the war, which is going ahead a bit. And my father coached him in seamanship and navigation and pilotage and so forth, because he happened to be at home at the beginning of the war, and got him into the RNVSR, Supplementary Volunteer Reserve, which was really yachtsman. And once again, the family doctor turned up and said, well, I hope you know what you're doing, but as I see it, he is likely to serve in little ships, trawlers and so forth, and they will take a lot of sea and he'll be wet, and there'll be nowhere for him to dry his clothes. And you know what will happen if he catches a cold, and that sort of thing. Anyway, having got him in, father had to be at even greater pains to get him out. And just to finish that off, he then went to the local agricultural college at Seal Hain, outside Newton Abbot, and worked very hard there, I think. And the war now being on, built up the stock. So more cows, we got a bull, and more pigs, and so forth, and the fields were all ploughed up, and we had cabbages in the front lawn, and potatoes everywhere, and so forth. And he made a very successful farmer, until eventually we had to leave, which wasn't until 1950 or so. And I think that's probably enough about my early life, isn't it?
Well, you've done very well, Sir Henry. It's an extraordinary story.
And off I went in, I think it was 1933, to my prep school. I never went to a kindergarten. And I went to St. Peter's Court in Broadstairs. Broadstairs was, of course, the other side of the country.
I was going to say.
But it was fashionable that you went to the other end or the other side of the country for a change of air. The advantage of Broadstairs was that it was creeping with prep schools. And so from a games-playing point of view, seldom did a Wednesday or a Saturday afternoon pass when you couldn't have a match. And that was marvellous. I come on to St. Peter's next, I think. Can we pause for a moment for that?
Of course, if you wish.
Well, I joined my prep school rather later than most. I was 9 and a half, And I joined 3 weeks late. Why? Because I had a cold. And there was this thing about colds in my family. And I say this in a rather derogatory way. But viewed from my mother's aspect, she'd lost one son from leukemia, she lost another from whooping cough. She very nearly lost my older brother from pneumonia. And so there was this thing about catching cold and so forth. My father used to sum it up because he didn't take too kindly to this and thought it was a bit overdone. And if anybody produced a handkerchief when he was around, he would say, "Have you got a cold?" And we would, of course, always say no, whether it was true or false. And he would say, "Then why are you blowing your nose?" And so on. But it didn't do much good for me because I suffered acutely as a small boy, and frankly still do, come to that, from hay fever. And my eyes were red and they ran, and you know, they itched like mad, and if you rubbed them, they got redder. So you were told not to rub your eyes, it really makes them sore, and that sort of thing. And you were constantly blowing your nose, and everybody was convinced that that was a cold and not hay fever, and so on. So it was an enormous constriction, really. However, I joined my prep school about 3 weeks after the normal start of the summer term in, I think it was 1933. And that was fine. It was, I quickly settled in. I went into the bottom form, and I can't remember the man's name who taught us, but he'd been a tea planter in the West Indies. Carr, I think his name was, yes, Mr. Carr. And he was as bald as a coot, but deeply tanned, and he wore a stiff white collar because, he said, it's so much cooler in the hot climate. Interesting. And there they all were, because they'd been at it for 3 weeks. And the main subject was Latin. And there they all were, declining the Latin for a table, mensa. I didn't know a word of Latin, or what its relevance was. I'm still not sure that I know about the relevance, but anyway. The requirement was to be able to say mensa, mensa, mensam, 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 mensas, etc. And it didn't strike me as being very difficult. So I went up after a couple of periods and said it. Whereupon our teacher turned to class and said, you better watch out, this chap is gobbling it all up. And so I've never forgotten it. And I thought, you know, I couldn't see what the problem was. Who had to learn six variants, you know, and then the plural thing afterwards. So we learned it. That was it. St. Peter's Court had magnificent playing fields. It had a couple of squash courts. It had a fives court. And it was a super place. The headmaster was a man called Gerald Ridgway, who was a clergyman. He had been number two, but way before my time, to the previous headmaster, who, or so the story went, when he found it necessary to beat you, used to bend you over, draw a chalk line on your bottom, on your trousers, and proceed to whack you until he hit the chalk. Now, I dare say that story lost nothing in the telling, but he didn't go on like that. With a charming wife and a bachelor son who even then was in his early 30s, 32, I think, and who never married, which was a sadness, but was a good sportsman, and he and his father were frightfully keen salmon fishermen, and they had a little cottage up in North Devon. I forget which river they fished, but that was the, in the spring and the summer, holes for them. And it was a no-nonsense school, and yet you had a very good relationship between the staff and the boys, very good. Thinking back, and I realized it at the time, in fact, we had one bad master. I'm not sure if he was really all that bad, but he was a bit of a bully, and he only lasted a couple of terms, and he was sorted out, and that was that. It was a very fine school. There were two particular characters. One was called Linford. Can't remember his, Alan Linford, I think it was. And he took the third form. And he was an elderly man, balding, and he had rather bad teeth. And he had one front tooth on a wire. And he had developed the habit, which was very entertaining to the boys, that he would fiddle with his tongue and project this one tooth on its wire and the end of his tongue outside his mouth and get back in again without using his hands. And he was known as Cork. Don't ask me why he was known as Cork, but he was. That was his nickname. And of course, if you were loved by the young, you had a nickname. And that goes on really for officers in the Navy afterwards. That was great fun. And he used to pretend to be frightfully cross, and he'd scowl. And eventually he'd end up by producing his tooth, and then everybody collapsed, of course, and that was that. And we would all say, "Oh, Cork." And the other character was the French teacher, Mademoiselle Lebrun. And because I was destined for the Navy, I had to be quite up for the hunt in French. And
you knew even at that stage you were destined for the Navy?
Yes, I'll return to that in a moment. I knew at a ridiculously early age that I was destined for the Navy. Mademoiselle Lebrun walked like a duck. She was short. She was very smartly dressed. She had a piece of luggage. I suppose nowadays one would call it a briefcase. In which she had a quantity of books and so forth. She would stump into the class that she was taking, and she took all classes, all levels, and she'd dump her luggage on the desk and start to unpack. And she was actually Belgian, not French. And she had been through, I think, as a nurse, certainly some of the First World War, and would occasionally regale us with stories of the wounded in hospital and all that sort of thing, in fairly stark terms. She was a very strict disciplinarian. She spoke heavily accented English, to say the least. And I don't know why I took to this, but one wet half-holiday afternoon, I suddenly, you know, everybody was a bit bored and didn't quite know what to do, and no games were being played and so forth. And I said I'd hold a bun class. She was known as the bun. And I got hold of an old rugger ball or something to simulate her luggage, and trotted out one or two of her more frequent sayings and so forth. And they all came and watched and roared with laughter and so forth. And that went on. That was a great success until the day came, and I was then having extra French lessons because of Dartmouth, when she turned up. And she took me by, I had a bit of a sort of quiff on my forehead in those days, sadly no longer. And she took me by this and led me out and said that either I stopped immediately or she would stop giving me extra French lessons. So I had to stop. And that was that. Then a lot of attention was paid to sport and games and coaching, therefore. And that was done with varying degrees of skill by those people, but it was very much encouraged. And I, who didn't reckon I was a natural, particularly, but I played a lot of squash, bit of fives, and I got into all three first teams 2 years running, ending up by being captain of rugger and head of the school. And then, going back a bit, I think this must have been about 1934 or so. I went back again, it's a summer term, and I went back at the normal start of the term, and I had a sore throat. Back to the cold business. So I didn't reveal this term. The throat got worse when I got back to school, not better. And I spent weeks in the SAM, and various people came and went, and clever doctors came and went, and so forth. At a certain stage, I was taken off to the local nursing home, a place called Cliff Coombe, set up by a man whose name I can't remember, who had been, he really lived for skiing. And when skiing 1 year, he had a ghastly smash and had broken, I think, both his legs badly. And drifted from hospital to hospital and so forth, largely on the continent, for a couple of years or so. And swore that if he ever got to the point where he could walk again, he would set up a nursing home where they would get this thing right. And he set up this place, Cliff Coombe. And I remember it was very fashionable, and all the actresses of the day would go there. And so the rooms, there were no wards or anything, and the rooms were given some famous name. And the occupant was referred to by that famous name, so it was complete anonymity. And I found I was carted off there in an ambulance, not feeling very well, but there it was. And I was put to bed, and they rigged a sort of tent over my carcass, and at the foot of the bed was paraffin, I suppose, heater. They flashed this thing up, and they gave me the maximum heat they could. And a nurse stood by me with one of those sort of things looking like a teapot with a spout to the side, pouring lemon squash or something into my mouth. I lost consciousness, and that was that. When I eventually came round, my mother had by then been summoned, and she would come and visit me, and so forth. And she booked into a local hotel, and apparently I had general septicemia. And by the time she had arrived on the scene, I was unconscious. So it was. That was one of my lives. And I was rather cosseted after that. For the rest of that, well, I effectively missed the whole of that term, but didn't do me much harm, really.
Do you know how you got it? Did it ever come to light how you got general septicemia?
I had Yes. And it goes back to the good old doctor. I had cuts or scratches or something or other on my fingers, and they went sour. And not very much was done about them. And the soreness spread. It's as simple as that. I don't know. Now, I'm going to go back a bit, because, and this was at Yana, my home, and it was shortly before my 11th birthday. I don't know why I was not at school, but anyway, I wasn't. And my father came back from a foreign commission.